This afternoon, we're going to be looking at the importance of what is called expository study. And to help you understand why it's important, just imagine that you wrote a manual on how to build a house. And this manual has a lot of detail, what you should do and how you should do it, what tools you should use and how they should be worked with, and how all this fits together. And then someone takes your manual and gives a lecture to someone, to a group of people. And in this lecture, they've decided that they want to use this to talk about nails. What are the different kinds of nails? Oh, this manual that we've got, it mentions masonry nails, and finish nails, and framing nails, and this kind of nails, and that kind of nails. And here are the characteristics of all these nails, and they talk about all this for a half hour. Or maybe even an hour. Will they have gotten the point of your manual? And the answer is no. The audience might learn things about nails, but it's not the point of your manual at all. The point of the manual is how to build this house and how to put these pieces together. And so if you're framing up this 2x4 to this plate, you use 10-penny nails and you put them in a certain way at a certain angle, and that's going to hold it. When you're doing another part, you use a different kind of nail and you put them in just like this so that it stays like it's supposed to. The focus is not on this particular element as much as it is how do you use this element to accomplish this project. Now, what I'm illustrating is the wrong approach here is the way the Bible is used in many, many churches. Instead of taking what God has said and going down through it and looking at what He's said and what is the point He's making, people say, oh, today I want to speak to you about whatever topic is on their mind. And so then they go to the Bible and they approach it like a smorgasbord. You know, at a smorgasbord, you see all these good things, and so you pick this and this and this and this and this and this. Just imagine if I came to your house and you fixed a wonderful meal for me. When I got there, I said, this is great. I think I'll have some of those pickles. And that'll go with this peanut butter sandwich I've got in my pocket. And I'll take a couple of those chips. And that'll go so good with this sausage that I brought along. And then I'll take just a little taste of this whipped cream that's on this chocolate thing. Because that'll be really neat with something I have in my knapsack. You'd be insulted. But you know, that's how people treat the Bible. Instead of taking what God has said, and let's trace through it and see what He's saying and what is the point, they use it as a resource book to get a stamp of approval on what they want to talk about. For example, suppose you're looking at Romans chapter 5. And many times people, even when they try to go down through a passage, they'll do things like this. You know, it talks about the love of God being shed abroad in our hearts, doesn't it, in Romans 5? Oh, the love of God. Well, that's great. Let's meditate on various aspects of the love of God, the way He sends rain on the just and on the unjust. God's love as manifested by sending rain on the just and on the unjust has nothing to do with the point that He's making in Romans chapter 5. We've got to quit grabbing pieces out of the Bible and just saying, let's enjoy looking at the pieces and start saying, what is the point of what God is saying in His revelation to us? Or for example, also in Romans chapter 5, it talks about Adam. Well, let's meditate on Adam. Oh, isn't that interesting how that God sent those animals in front of him 2x2 and how that was just wonderful to prepare Adam for realizing, hey, I would like to have someone too. You might have some useful meditation there, but that has nothing to do with the point of what he's saying in Romans chapter 5 about Adam. Now, if you like, you can turn to Isaiah 40, verse 6 to 8. The voice said, cry out. And he said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, because the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. You notice? All the loveliness of flesh is like grass. It's transient. It's temporary. So, every preacher, by the way, is temporary. He's fading. He's going to pass away. And so all the clever outlines and all of the fancy oratory is going to pass away. But what lasts forever? Look at verse 8. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. In other words, what we need to do is be preaching what lasts forever. Our job is to do like someone said, when you get done, you ought to be able to say, I didn't say anything. I just showed you what's there. And so our job is to open up before people's minds what God has said. And so that they say, oh, so that's in that passage. I don't know why I didn't see it. It's right there in front of me. Now, the value of proceeding from the passage itself is it forces us to think God's ideas instead of our own. It forces us to think what God's thoughts are instead of using His words to support our ideas. It also forces us to address aspects that we would ordinarily skip. You know, there are just certain things that are very touchy. And maybe there's something going on in this congregation. And if I would just pick the topic, somebody would say, oh, somebody tipped you off. Somebody told you that there was this thing, and you're pointing your finger. But if I'm going down through a passage and just picking out what's there, and it tramples on somebody's toes, well, too bad. That's God's word. And by the way, it also helps people to become inspired about God's message and how clear and obvious and wonderful it is. So let's learn to understand how to expound a passage. What does that mean? What does it mean to study the passage in an expository way? Turn to Romans chapter 5. Here's a passage that sometimes people find difficult. And so we're going to do a little interactive study here to find out what Romans chapter 5 is talking about. You know, there are many times that I do this. There are many times I come to a passage and I think, what in the world does this mean? And so here's the way to start. Let's suppose you come to a passage and you say, I don't know what it means. You simply write down in your own words, in a short abbreviated way, what you see in the verse. Don't worry about what it means. Just write down what you see in the verse. You don't have to understand it. You just write down what it says. But in your own words. Don't just quote it. Just write it down in your own words, what it means. For example, there's a verse in Corinthians that says that there are some people who are baptized for the dead. What does it mean? You might not know what it means, but you know what it says. So if you were coming to that part, you just write down some people are baptized for the dead. Fine. That's all we're doing right now. It's the first thing you do. You observe what's there. So Romans chapter 5, verse 1. We're going to go down through a few verses here so that we learn how to do this. What the goal is, we're going to use these observations. Then once we have the observations, we will look at them and say, oh, these observations here are all talking about the same thing. So that's really talking about topic A. And then these down here are talking about something else. That's topic B. We're beginning to outline the passage. You see, we'll begin to see the flow of what God is saying. So we aren't just saying, let's talk about point one and point two and point three. We're saying, let's see what he's saying here. Well, these all points are talking about this certain thing, and these are talking about this certain thing, and these are talking about this certain thing. And so then we have God is talking about A, and then B, and then C, and that is the point of what he's making. So the first thing we need to do is just simply write down what we see. So Romans chapter 5, verse 1. What do you see in that verse? All you do is write down something just very brief. Well, let me get you started. Because of justification, we have peace with God. What's verse 2 say? You're just making a quick little observation of what it is.
We have access to grace through Christ.
Okay. We have access to grace by faith. Now, if you notice what I'm doing, I'm just making it abbreviated so we can glance at it and get the basic idea in the verse. Now, sometimes a verse might have several things in it, and you want to list what they are. But what else is it saying? Is there anything else it's saying in verse 2 that we haven't mentioned?
We stand in rejoicing with the hope of the glory of God.
Okay, so we rejoice in hope of the glory of God. Okay, verse 3. Okay, we glory in tribulations. And then there's something connected to that, right? Because, so let's just put under here, because what? Of what it produces. Right? And then there's a long list of things. So we'll say 3A here, and then 3B, and what else is it? 3B and 4. Does everyone see what I'm doing? So it's what it produces, that's 3B through 4. See, all we're doing right now is just looking at what's there, and then here we notice there's a connection here. This is sort of under this thing. How about verse 5? What's in there?
Hope doesn't put us to shame because of God's love.
Hope does not make us ashamed. That's verse 5. Verse 6. What is that saying?
We're still weak, Christ died.
When we were still weak, Christ died for us. And we could say, instead of Christ died for us, died for ungodly people. That would clarify it a little bit. Verse 7, what's it say? Only rarely would someone dare to die even for a good person. Verse 8.
Christ died for us while we were sinners.
9.
Since we're justified by his blood, we will be saved from wrath.
Okay, but let's put something else in here that's really important. Two words right at the beginning. Much more. See, it's making a big point here. Much more something. So we'll put much more, having been justified, we will escape wrath. Verse 10. Well, if we were enemies and were reconciled, then what do you see there again? A key word? Much more. See, you don't emphasize that because here it's coming again. Much more will be saved by his life. I'm not going to try to write more of that right in there. I'm running out of space here. But in other words, what you want to do is just put in brief form, in your own words, what it's saying. You're just observing. That's the first thing you do when you study the Bible. You observe. Verse 11, what is it?
I notice the duplication of phrases, not only that. Verse 3, not only that. Verse 11, not only that.
Okay, that's important. That's good. That's another case where you're seeing something that's there. So you jot it down because it might be important in terms of understanding the flow of the passage. That's good. He's saying, not only that, we rejoice in God. What do people often rejoice in? Themselves, what they've agreed upon, or whatever. But see, we're rejoicing in God because he provides this reconciliation. Verse 12. Name something that verse 12 is saying.
Okay, because, not just man's sin, but because of Adam's sin, death spread to all.
We'll just stop right there with that part. Now what you do is you start looking at your page. You can probably see it better if you look at your page instead of mine. But you look at that page and you start saying, what's he talking about here? Do this and this go together? First two things, first three things, or whatever. Do you see anything, how these go together? Do you see how this is sort of talking about the same thing? We have justification, we have peace with, what's it say? Peace with God. We have access by faith into this grace, and we rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. We have a new standing. You see how this stuff sort of comes together? We have peace with God. That's a new standing with God, isn't it? We have access to grace by faith. That's a whole new kind of position. We're not in a treadmill business. We're in access to this grace that he pours out to enable you to have power over sin. We rejoice in the hope of the glory of God. In other words, there's going to be even more glory that's going to follow. We have a whole new standing of things. What about this next part? We glory in tribulations. Is that the natural way of doing things? See, we have a new standing here. But also, we glory in tribulations because this produces this, produces this, produces this. And this hope does not make us ashamed because of the love of God which is poured out in our hearts. Then you come along and say, when we were still weak, Christ died for us. Is he talking about the same thing? Is he talking about something else now? He's talking about when we were still weak, Christ died for us. If somebody would die for a good man, that would be unusual. But much less, of course, for a bad man. And then Christ died for us while we were still sinners, much more having been justified to escape wrath. This next section talks about our new outlook. You see, we glory in tribulations. That's not the normal way of thinking. We glory in tribulations. Why? Because of what we know it will produce when we respond properly to those tribulations. And then this hope doesn't make us ashamed because the love of God has been poured out in our hearts. Then all of a sudden you have a shift. He starts talking about Christ dying for us when we were weak and dying for us when we were ungodly and dying for us when we were sinners and how unusual that would be. So you see verse 6 through 11 is talking about a whole nother topic. Verses 6 through 8 is talking about how amazing it is that Christ died for us. Because what? Verse 6, we were weak. Verse 7, in essence, we're unrighteous. Verse 8, we were sinners. So, truly amazing that Christ would die for us. So we'll just say amaze. And you might say, well, I don't know what to put on these levels, but you can see how it groups together. And as you begin to look at it, you might see better what it's really saying. So verse 6 to 8 is talking about the amazing kind of love that he had, that Christ died for us. But then verse 9 through 11, what is it saying? Just glance down at your paper. What is it saying that's an advance on verses 6 through 8? If verses 6 through 8 are talking about how amazing God's love was for us, then what is verse 9 through 11 saying? In other words, once you're, if God did this for you when you were wicked, now he's got you reconciled and justified, how much more will he do for you that he's got you in the right relationship with him? So you see, this section here is the much more. Now, look at verse 12. Is verse 12 talking about the same thing? It's launching into a different something. You don't have to worry about what it is, but it's like he's talking about what? All of a sudden, he says what? How sin entered the world. And then if you read down through the rest of the verses, it's going to be telling you, here's what happened, sin entered the world, this and this happened, and he's going to... So you understand what I mean. This is another topic right down here. Do you follow me? Now you see what's happening? We're beginning to understand the passage. First thing we came to it, we didn't know what the passage was talking about necessarily, but we just started writing down what we saw in each verse. Then as you glance at those short little things it's saying in each verse, you can say, oh, I see, this is connected, and this is connected, and this is talking about how dastardly we were and God sent Christ for us. This is talking about much more, and then this is talking about something about Adam and how sin entered the world and all that. So you see, still, we don't have to really know what the passage is meaning. We're just getting it piece by piece. Well, he's talking about our standing. He's talking about our outlook. He's talking about the amazing love. He's talking about how much more God is going to do for us since we're justified. And then he's telling us about how sin entered the world and all of that. Now, do you get the picture? That means that our understanding of this passage flows right out of the passage. This is what I do over and over and over and over and over. Because many times when you come to a passage, what in the world does this mean? Just start writing down what you see. Any questions on that? That's what I'm going to have you do on another day. So you can, in your spare time, when you go home, you can practice. Now, I want you to notice that as you put this information of just stuff you see, then patterns begin to emerge. You begin to see what's going on. Louis Pasteur, remember he was the man who discovered germ theory, that diseases were carried by germs. He said this, where observation is concerned, chance favors only the prepared mind. End of quote. Repeating it. Where observation is concerned, chance favors only the prepared mind. You know, the more you study the Bible, the more you find out that's true. Because it's like, as you study this, Your mind gets prepared more and more, and you begin to see things that you didn't see at earlier stages because your mind is prepared to do it. Now, let me give you an illustration. How many of you know what a brain teaser is? Anybody? You know, you have these little stories about how somebody, for example, here's a brain teaser. A man was hunting one day, and he had his camp at a certain place. He walked 1 mile south, 1 mile west, shot a bear. Then he walked 1 mile north, got back to his camp. What color was the bear? That's an example of a brain teaser. You have to figure this out. Well, you know, after you've read a lot of those brain teasers, and then you come to a new one, you sort of know sort of how your mind is prepared for the kind of things that happen. And so it's easier for you to get the new one you've never seen than it was for you years earlier. Well, see, that same thing is true in studying the Bible. Chance, Pasteur was saying chance, favors the prepared mind. And this is one of the ways you prepare your mind, because you're just looking at what's there. And then you begin to see connections with things. You begin to see how it fits together. Yes.
I'm thinking this might be a beneficial approach, even the passages we think we understand.
Oh, yes.
Because we bring so much baggage from previous years that we just think we know what this means, and we read through it, and we don't get the depth that's there.
That's really good. The idea is that even passages we think we understand, take them and just write down your observations and then outline it. See the flow of the passage, because that really does help you see things in the passage that you've missed over many, many times. But see, what it's forcing you to do is to look carefully at it. So, you know, if you've copied it word for word, that is a step in the right direction, but it helps us even more if we think about it enough that we can say it in our own words without making it a quote, because that forces us to think about it. And also, you see, you want it to be real short, so that you can glance at it at a moment and say, oh, I see this and this and this and this are connected, and then this and this and this are connected. Whereas if you have the whole verse each time, you can't just glance at it that, it's difficult to glance at it that fast. And so it helps us get the picture. That's what we're trying to do, get the picture. Now, let me give you an example of topical exposition. See, this is what we would call passage exposition. We just go down through a section of Romans 5. There is another kind of exposition called topical because, for example, I've often taught on family life and child training and husband-wife relationships, and those things do not all appear at the same place in the Bible. But there is an improper approach to this. For example, let's suppose I would begin to prepare a sermon, and so I would say to myself, what are the 3 fundamental issues for a wonderful marriage? Well, good communication, that'd be one of them. And having quality time with your wife, that'd be another. And dividing up responsibilities appropriately, that'd be another. Now, all those points, I can go to the Bible somewhere and find some verses that'll fit those points. And so then I could think up some examples of people I knew that did point 1 and some that did point 2 and somebody didn't do point 3, and you could add that in and you could have a sermon. Would it be God's message? No, it wouldn't be. And that's how many sermons are that you hear. They aren't God's message. They're just a man saying his own ideas with Bible verses tacked on to support those ideas. Another improper approach in terms of topical exposition is preaching through the concordance. Somebody says, oh, I think I should have a message on fear. And so they open up the concordance, and according to the computer program that I happen to have in the New King James Version, there was 450 references to fear. There are hundreds of examples. You can imagine, you know, you shall fear the Lord your God, and J.L. told Sisera, do not fear, and Psalm 23, I will fear no evil. But the problem is, you're going to miss verses that don't contain that specific wording. Adam said, I was afraid because I was naked. Doesn't have the word fear in it. But even so, you can find this long list, but a long list of verses on fear is not inspiring, is it? In that long list, you can find a verse like, perfect love casts out fear. And people can elaborate on that verse. But you know what the context teaches? The context gives enlightenment because it's talking about fear on the judgment day. It's not talking about present day fear. So here's my suggestion. Instead of doing that, say to yourself, where in the Bible do I know of any people that were afraid? Who's afraid in the Bible?
Roman soldiers when the angel appeared.
Okay, the Roman soldiers when the angel appeared. That's one of them. Who's another one?
King whose knees both one on
the right, Belshazzar. He was afraid. Who else is afraid? The disciples in the boat. So let's take that one for example. The disciples in the boat. They had seen the healings, the feeding of the multitude, and now they're out there in the boat, and the waves are contrary, and the wind's blowing, and these fellows had been on the boat before, but they were in a big storm. They're terribly afraid. And Jesus says, peace, be still. And then they were really afraid. Why? Because they saw this person had power over the universe like they hadn't seen yet. I mean, if he can make the wind stop and the waves stop just like that, what else could he do? He's dangerous. Now, do you see what I'm getting at? When you start going down through these passages where people were afraid, you begin to understand why they were afraid, how God met them in that fear, what God wanted them to understand about fear, and what God wanted them to understand about himself. You can go down through multitudes of passages. Jacob was afraid of Esau at Jabbok. Gideon was afraid, but he obeyed. Peter was walking on the water, and he was afraid. I mean, you go through passages like this, and you begin to realize, why were they afraid? What was happening? What were they doing? What was their failure? And how did God meet them? Jeroboam was afraid that the people would revert to the southern kingdom when they go down to worship in Jerusalem. So he set up those golden calves. Does that remind you of anybody's fears these days? You can set up golden calves to accomplish your spiritual goals today too, right? And then, of course, as you go through those passages, you might say, this episode here really fits with a certain verse over here that specifically talks about fear in one of the New Testament passages. So let me give you another topic. This is a topic that I'm going to have you do for an assignment. Let's suppose that you feel like that you should speak to some people regarding spiritual depression. Any of you ever encountered spiritual depression in anyone? Okay. So if you say, well, spiritual depression, I wonder where the Bible speaks about that.
I'd say Psalms would be a great place to start.
Okay, that's a good point. Psalms is a great place to start. You see, there actually is no place where it specifically says, you know, here's how you cure spiritual depression. You might remember a verse in the King James, Proverbs 12:25, heaviness in the heart of a man maketh it stoop, but a good word maketh it glad. Or Proverbs 12:25, anxiety in the heart of man causes depression, but a good word makes it glad. That's a different translation. Now, you could use those verses as the power of positive thinking. Feel better about stuff, and it'll give you more positive attitude. Or you could be saying, well, let's see. What causes depression? Oh, somebody's spouse died. Well, that'd make you feel depressed. Or somebody lost their job. They feel depressed. Or maybe they got really sick. Or maybe they had a car accident. They feel depressed. Or maybe doors closed on their ministry. They feel depressed. Those would be causes for depression, wouldn't they not? So, can you find any Bible verses that'll fit those things? Well, sure, you can find Bible verses. Just tack them on there. And guess what? It's your ideas with tacked on Bible verses. The problem is, it's man's message, not God's. Now, a much better method is to do what he was saying. Look in the Psalms, and you find lots of cases where the person is depressed. My enemies are coming after me. They're doing all these things. It's so terrible. And then he turns toward God, and God is the answer to his depression. So you can find people in the Bible that were depressed. Who were they? David was one of them. He was depressed lots of times. You can read about it in the Psalms. But you know, one of the reasons that David is listed as a man after God's own heart is because as he had all these troubles came upon him, then he would start thinking about God and who he was and what God was going to do. And by the time he's done with the psalm, usually he's talking about praising God. Who else is depressed in the Bible? Jonah was depressed. I'd be depressed too if I was in the belly of a fish. So now here's what you'll do. This is an assignment. Find at least three people in the Bible that were depressed, find out what caused their depression, how God met them in that depression, how they responded to that depression, and what we're supposed to learn from that whole thing. So let's just list some people to help you get going. Job, Jonah, David. Who else was depressed in the Bible? Peter. Yes. Who else is depressed? John. Which John?
John the Baptist.
Yes. When he said, "Do we look for another?" Okay. Judas was depressed. There's lots more. Ahab was depressed. He couldn't get the garden he wanted. Remember, he turned his face to the wall? His wife helped him out, didn't she? Not in a good way, of course. What about Mary and Martha regarding Lazarus? What'd they say? "Lord, if you had been here, our brother wouldn't have died." Jeremiah, was he depressed? And Jeremiah said at one point, he said, "Cursed is the day that I was ever born." Very similar to what Job said. He was depressed. Elijah was depressed. Now, you see, when you study all those passages and find out what was the cause of their depression by looking at the context of the passage, that'll be pretty obvious, won't it? You won't be guessing. And you'll be able to look and see how God met them in that depression. That'll be obvious. And then what they were supposed to do, some of them responded one way, some responded another. By the time you're done with all those examples of the scripture, you will know a lot about spiritual depression and its causes and its cure. And you aren't making it up. You aren't just reading it in some book. Here's what I want you to do. Pick three of them that you want. Study those passages in relation to depression. Its cause, how God met them, how they responded to it, what we're supposed to learn. But I want you to work on that between now and the next session. Because then we're going to discuss some of this in the next session.